Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Sarah Pascoe.
Hello, I'm Carrie Ad-Lloyd.
And we're weird about books.
We love to read.
We read too much.
We talk too much.
About the too much that we've read.
Which is why we've created
the Weirdos Book Club.
Join us!
A space for the lonely outsider to feel accepted and appreciated.
A place for the person who'd love to be in a real book club but doesn't like wine or nibbles.
Or being around other people.
Is that you? Join us.
Check out our Instagram at Sarah and Carrie Ad's Weirdos Book Club for the upcoming books we're going to be discussing.
You can read along
and share your opinions.
Or just skulk around in your raincoat like the weirdo you are.
Thank you for reading with us. We like reading with you.
This week's book guest is In Watermelon Sugar by Richard Brautigan.
What's it about? In Watermelon Sugar is set in the aftermath of a fallen civilization. There's a commune called I Death. They're trying to live in peace in the shadow of a violent past.
What qualifies it for the Weirdos Book Club? Well, the main character has no name. Everything in the commune is made of watermelon sugar or trout juice. And they talk about carrots a lot.
In this episode, we discuss hippies,
Harry Styles,
beat poets,
sad childhoods,
and having your girlfriend on the front cover.
And joining us this week is John Kearns. John is an award-winning comedian, the only person to have won Best Newcomer and then Best Show at the Edinburgh Fringe in concurrent years. He is also Sarah Pascoe's able assistant on Dave's Guessable.
And he was a contestant on the 14th series of Taskmaster, and today he's agreed to read a very weird novel with us. We have a trigger warning. In this episode, there are references to suicide. John Kearns!
John Kearns!
Thanks for having me. Hello.
Thank you so much for being here to discuss In Watermelon Sugar by Richard Brautigan.
Yeah, if we are even really here, maybe we're actually in a place called iPodcast Studio.
Yeah.
iPlayer Death Podcast Studio.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
I, John Kearns.
John Kearns, yeah.
I, Kearns. John Kearns. That's what I'm going to call you. I, Kearns and I, Pascoe.
Yeah. Before we booked you,
yeah,
when we were trying to find a date, there was some trepidation that you didn't want a long book. So we chose a really short one.
A light. It's light. Look at it. You could pop that in a top pocket of a suit jacket.
Yeah, you wouldn't even crease your shirt up, would you?
Yeah.
Which I have done.
Yeah. Okay, so it's pretty, I mean, I say 140 pages. Some of them are just halves or thirds.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I like that. Those pages were absolutely brilliant.
So we chose you the shortest book we could.
Yep.
How'd you get on?
Percy Reasonable, we should start with a little bit about what it's about.
Okay, sorry. Before
let's just be kind to John before we...
Okay.
So,
In Watermelon Sugar.
In Watermelon Sugar. Watermelon Sugar.
I know. You had that in your head whole time?
Yes, the whole time. The Harry Styles tune, which was inspired by this book, the title of the book.
Yes, here's the thing.
Yeah. I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. All right.
I'm with you. Just...
So
I just want you to know.
The song is not inspired by it.
No,
he saw it on the side. Yes.
He saw it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And stole the title
and hadn't read the book.
Whereas,
despite its lightness, Styles couldn't even be asked to do 140
pages. Even on
a
lunch break, recording his album. What's he reading on his phone?
Also, surely you'd have to read it, because imagine if someone was like, "Oh, that book is really offensive, Harry."
Yeah.
Like,
okay. Yeah.
You'd read it. Maybe one of his people read it. Yeah.
That's a book about slavery. Why have you called your song Watermelon Sugar over and over again?
Watermelon Sugar. Exactly. Oh, it's a great phrase.
So
it's written by Richard Brautigan.
There's some very excited dads who've written articles about the fact that Richard Brautigan has been brought back into fashion by Harry Styles, but he hasn't.
No.
And he wasn't. And it's nothing to do with the book.
Well, those are excited dads. They're just hoping their youth comes back, aren't they? But it's not. It's not. It's about a man who lives in a place called Ideth, which is made of watermelon sugar and trout juice.
Trout oil. And pine. Something's and a pine.
And it's sort of a commune. And I would say it's a very... it was published in 1968 and it's very, very summer of love, end of 60s, slightly trippy, you don't quite know what's real. Perhaps we could all live in a commune together and maybe that would be fine.
Yeah, it's dreamlike surrealism.
Short chapters, just for John. Not too long. Nice and quick.
Abrupt ending.
So yeah, if you haven't heard of Watermelon Sugar, that's roughly the story. It's about a man living on a sort of commune in a shed and the people who live there. That's basically what it's about. How'd you get on?
First off, I'm a slow reader.
Yeah. I think it's because you absorb it properly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We went to Melbourne and you were
reading John Gray. So I know you read heavy books, meaningful books.
I do.
And you think about what you've read.
I do think about what I've read. But I buy books thinking that's definitely what I need in my brain. Mm-hmm. Those are the thoughts I need. That will challenge me.
Mm.
And then I crack it open and by the end of page one, I'm like,
Don't want to be challenged.
I'm not who I am. The problem was, so when I went, give me something short if that's all right. The shorter the book, the more meaning there
is. Like a poem, right?
Exactly.
The shortest book of all.
Yeah. Full of meaning.
Yeah.
You are Seamus Heaney. Those are not light.
Yeah. No, they're not. It was true. But like, so I thought if you give me like something 600 pages, I'm like, that is a lot of rope for me to, do some damage to myself. So I thought, if it's short, I can get my head around it.
Yeah. But we sent you a short psychedelic novel.
Wait, no, you've sent me a psychedelic novel that is a parable.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, I read a New York Times review of it from the time.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I read that.
They said it cannot be summarised.
Well, I disagree. I just did it.
Well, you did it, actually. I'm looking at you going, that's basically what it was about. Yeah.
But that ignores any meaning. I'm just telling
I would argue that is true of all books.
Yeah.
Because if they could be summarised, you could tweet it. You wouldn't need to write an entire book.
Exactly. That's very
surely?
True.
What, you could tweet the book?
If any book could be summarised fairly... It's not fair to summarise any book.
I feel like that's too big a question for John and we're going to get stuck on that and I need to get back to the book.
That question itself was made from watermelon sugar.
Because we haven't
actually
gotten...
Well, that's the thing with this book. I mean, Jesus Christ, you're reading it, you think you're onto something, you're like, finally, I get what's going. And then he goes, and I put my mug down on the table that was made of watermelon sugar. You're like, what the fuck is he talking about?
And it tells you right at the beginning.
Oh, so everything is made of watermelon.
For the listener.
Yeah, desks. But the reason is because everything that they have is made out of watermelon sugar and everything they have is life.
Yep.
Easy. I mean, he says that right at the beginning.
Imagine my joy when I read that. Right, what's this book I've been giving it? Page one, everything's made out of watermelon sugar.
We make a great many things out of watermelon sugar here. I'll tell you about it, including this book being written near Ideth. All this will be gone into, travelled in watermelon sugar. Yeah.
There are people listening now going, Jesus Christ.
1968, mate. 1968.
Yep. Well,
he was a beat poet, the last of the beat poets he's known as. So he was at a time where you could write everything's made of watermelon sugar and people wouldn't go, what? They went, yeah.
Well, you say that because this is a heavy influence to the Mighty Boosh, which is a much more modern incarnation of everything's made of watermelon sugar. The scene, there's only one scene I find annoying.
Oh, yeah.
Because I really like this book.
You really like this book.
Did I tell you why? It reminds me of CBD. As in, like,
very... You're going to say CBBs, but it went off for
CBDs.
I was like,
but it's like, what, a watermelon theme for the week?
So the oil.
Have you taken CBD oil before bed?
I know of its effects.
You know of its effects. So, your brain's not switched off.
Yeah, but it sort of, like, mellows it.
You're not high.
No.
But you're slightly lazier.
That soporific feeling
is how I feel about this book.
Well, look, I may have given the wrong impression.
Oh.
I did not like this book.
All right.
It's hard not to like to actively dislike it, I think, but it is, you can be frustrated by it. Like all good beatniks. you like them, but get a job. Come on, shave your beard. What's going on?
There was a segment I found annoying.
Oh, yes.
It's only because it reminded me of a sort of a kind of man in a nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
who won't tell you his real name.
Oh, God, yeah, this bit.
So it's like...
Yes.
If you're thinking about something that happened a long time ago, somebody asked you a question, you did not know the answer, that is my name. Perhaps it was raining very hard, that is my name. But that's directly... there's a Mighty Boosh scene where a character does that whole thing of like...
I've forgotten that.
Yeah.
Your name's Richard. That's your name.
I first heard of this author on a podcast, Robin Ince and Josie's Book Shambles, and it was Noel Fielding saying this was his favourite author.
That explains a lot, doesn't it?
Yes, so I can see why that. While it's not the 60s, people do still make...
Oh, yes, yeah, still like
play
that.
With meaning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In a comedic way.
Yes, I can completely
Did you think
that.
It was funny, John?
I did. I did find it funny. It reminds... Right, where do I begin with this thing? the one thing I liked about it... Surrealism could put people off, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Massively.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't have read this book if I hadn't...
had to.
I was going
to
say been made or had
contractually obliged. Yeah. too awkward to get out of it the night before. Yeah.
Oh, God.
And it's not something you can bluff. This podcast, you can't bluff it.
You have to read it.
You've got to do your
crucially.
Homework. Yeah.
For anyone listening to this, maybe a future guest or something, read the book.
You've got to read it.
So what I liked about it, and I think I don't want to make this navel gazing into maybe what a stand up comedian does, but if you are surreal in your stand up, you got to root it somehow.
Yes,
and all the dialogue is funny.
I think.
It's quite flat.
Yeah,
quite childlike.
It's very childlike.
Naive.
It's funny you say that because it reminded me of. It's almost deadpan, so it reminded me of like John Classen books, like
I want my hat back.
Just this kind of.
I love him.
It reminded me of children playing at being grown ups. That would you like some pie? I've made some pie. Well, pie is better than carrots.
No, the amazing bit when
it's like Twin Peaks.
It's very Twin Peaks when it says about Al always cooks carrots, and then Pauline makes a stew, and there's a bit where like somebody says, "At least it wasn't carrots." And everyone goes, and Al goes, what? And they're like, the stew is nice. Like, it's like, don't tell Al that we don't like his carrots.
But then when Al does cook the carrots, in his defence, delicious.
Yeah,
delicious
they sound
caramelised.
Well, that's what, I think also the use of food in it.
There's loads of food
again, roots it. Because you read it going like, there's a, when they describe breakfast, I don't know, maybe I was hungry when I read the book.
Yeah, the hotcakes.
He mentioned hotcakes and hash browns. Yeah. And I was like, that sounds fantastic.
No, and also, do you want another one? Yeah, you want another one. Pauline's going to make you another hotcake.
Oh, yeah, she's a great cook, apparently. So, like, the dialogue that they have and what they eat is just very grounding.
Yeah, it's so almost then, like English as a second language, isn't it? Like, you'd read in a textbook of, like, that was nice, thank you. Also, thank you. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, a language textbook.
But that's funny, you know. That's you know, you're reading that kind of, you know, I was chuckling away. Never said that in my life.
Chuckling away.
But there is a, and a, you know, I presume anyone reading this won't mind spoilers or anything.
Oh, no, we're spoiling
it. About three quarters of the way through, a character called Margaret.
Oh, Margaret's hilarious.
She is hilarious.
The first mention of Margaret had me chuckling away.
Oh, yeah, that's very funny.
When
that's very funny.
He's describing someone basically coming to knock on his door, he doesn't open it, and she particularly stands on the same board of a bridge.
Creaky board.
I can walk across the bridge hundreds of times without stepping on that board, but Margaret always steps on it. You just go, I feel I got a vibe of Margaret from that one sentence.
So I loved that.
So you're going to talk about the trauma of Margaret's ending?
Well,
is that what you're going to talk about?
She commits suicide. Mm. She hangs herself. Mm-hmm. The way it's described in there by the narrator, whose name we don't know, is childlike.
Mm. But so is the death of his parents.
Yes, who are eaten by tigers.
Yes, who... So the tigers...
Who then do maths with him.
Yeah, help him with his arithmetic.
They play trumpets. They've got good voices.
Yeah. Well, someone said it's like, are they tigers or is this, they use the word tigers, but it's a humans in a different form, but that's the word they use, but we're humans that use tigers as meaning an animal. So again, nothing is grounded in that way. Like, you're never quite sure.
How do you read it? Because there is obviously, as soon as you read that there's these tigers that eat his parents and then help him with his maths homework. Obviously, your first thought is, oh, what is this an allegory of and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I actually found it much easier.
Yeah, I didn't think allegory straight away. No, I imagined tigers. Yeah, I was like, tigers.
Now, we have children.
Yeah.
We all probably have a copy of The Tiger Who Came to
Tea.
It's my son's favourite book.
Oh, brilliant.
That's all I'm picturing. I'm picturing that guy.
Mm. Yeah.
But
drank all of Dan's beer. Time to eat your parents.
Yeah, I have to tell him not to. He says that on the bus a lot. Dan's beer. And I'm like, it's from the book.
Mine says
it's quite
as
sexist,
well.
That book.
It is. It's very, beer. Very old. It was written a long time ago.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book.
Yeah.
Okay. Carrie's always being, defending sexism.
I'll defend it till the women come home, as they should.
I'll defend it till the women come home.
Come on.
I'll march on that. Yeah. I will march on that.
I've written, horror is described with exaggerated civility.
Oh, that's a very good sentence,
Thank
Sarah Pascoe.
You
should be a writer.
But can I tell you why I don't think it's allegory? Because eye death, which obviously is before Apple.
Yes, before iPlayer and iPods.
It is talked about, and I'm probably going to misremember, I think it might be Carl Jung, but as ego death. So if you take ego out of everything, you have a life quite similar to this one in Watermelon Sugar.
Yeah, yeah.
With the In Boyle gang.
So we say there's a person called In Boyle.
Yes.
Who is the brother
and he's
Charlie.
Sort of a baddie.
He is a definite baddie, yeah.
He is a baddie.
He goes and makes whiskey and hangs out with the Forgotten Works,
yes,
which
and
you
the
take to be...
whiskey's made from forgotten things, which in some ways made it even more stinky. It was really real and disgusting, wasn't it?
Yeah, they seemed gross, those guys.
Yeah.
They seemed a bit incel-y,
didn't they? There's threatening behaviour from them, which is completely self-directed when it does finally happen.
Yes, that there is a horrific scene where they kind of march on the camp of eye death to shout and say that this is a lie, this is fake.
But that's why I thought it was about ego death, because they're saying, you don't know eye death, this is all a joke, you're not even doing eye death, this is eye death. And they start chopping off their own ears and noses and thumbs.
Faces, and they basically,
this is ego death, like literally the death of the self.
It's one of those books you could put anything onto it because it is so allegorical and simple. But this is a question for everybody. I don't know if he knows. I don't feel like Richard Bordenkin
don't think
knows.
The writer is in control.
I don't think so. I think he's just putting down
it's nice.
This stuff that's coming out of his head.
Yeah.
And because, you know, 1968.
And he does tell you at the end how quickly he wrote it. Pretty bloody quickly.
3 months.
Yeah. Yeah. And he apparently did this in all of his books. He would write how much, and it was a kind of a brag. And he would also, on the cover of all of his books, have a picture of himself and his current girlfriend.
Oh, yeah, the muses. Yeah. I read an article, or started to read an article, by a man saying how nice it was that at least the women who inspired it were actually sort of photographed.
No, it was whoever he was with at the time. They weren't inspired. Like, and the first book that he's very famous for, Trout Fishing in America.
Yes, I've read that one as well.
The woman on that became very well known. So the girlfriend at the time, Watermelon Sugar, like went to quite an effort for her picture because she knew this was about to become one of those 1960s pictures where people go, oh, you're so-and-so from that book cover.
Yeah.
So there's that going on as well. And he was accused very much of not being particularly great with his female relationships. And he also came from a very... lots of trauma in his background as well. But my feeling, you agree? I don't think he knows what he means by watermelon sugar.
So it doesn't matter.
He's putting the tracks down.
Yeah.
You know, like when Gromit's on the train. I think he's doing that.
Yeah, but he's not expecting to know where he's going.
So the other word I wrote down, and I hate that I wrote this down, is jazz. And I hate
I've never wrote down that word.
Okay, I hate it. My dad's a jazz musician. I've got a jazz dad. I hate jazz.
I love jazz.
Okay, so this is jazz improvisation, which is like...
Yes, it is. I agree with you.
And the people who do it consider themselves geniuses, whether it is or not. Look, but the thing is, the amazing thing about watching it happen is laying down some notes and motifs and sounds and then strengthening them. And that's what this book does. Margaret, it is Margaret's story, and you don't see that coming. It sets up really small details about the watermelon sugar, about the watermelons. Oh, the watermelons are different colours every day. It's the same colour as the sun.
The sun changes colour, yeah.
There's such coherence in the way that those things are built up.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's not done lazily.
There's a statue of a parsnip over there. Later on, finding out about...
Lots of vegetables.
Yeah, the obsession with vegetables.
Well, there's a Beach Boys album called Smile, and there's a track called Vegetables.
Oh, yeah.
And I've always been baffled by it. It's like the way Brian Wilson phrases it, he goes vegetables and then it goes into furniture and it's just absolutely
bonkers.
But I was reminded of that reading this book, like that Beach Boys album specifically, which is again late 60s. Mm. And I mean, I don't know, you obviously don't want to, well, you can't help it, but it is very much a book of its time.
Very much of its time,
and,
yeah, definitely.
You know, the book is basically going, why can't we all live where everyone just gets on and lives a nice kind of tranquil...
But it is saying that, but it isn't saying that. That's why I think it's interesting, because they then all chop themselves up and it's not a safe
commune.
Because
even if the tigers have all been burned and there's just a trout hatchery, still, you break someone's heart, and that description of Margaret sort of standing
ostracized,
on nothing in the air... sort of the end of Margaret and her heartbreak. And the point is...
And he replaces her like that with no
feelings.
And he
keeps saying it doesn't matter. Yeah. And even like when her brother finds out she's dead, it's like, what was to be done? She was heartbroken.
Yeah.
So the brother's reaction is cold.
Which is why I think, because all of the death, whether it's your parents being eaten by tigers or it's your sister or it's the In Boyle gang, they don't have emotional reactions.
Yeah, there's not consequences. I read another thing saying, it predicts the end of the 60s and the kind of, you know, the horribleness that started coming into. But I don't know if it, I don't know if that's, again, people projecting things.
But the reading on it, if you were alive in the 60s and someone said, he's really summing up here and now, you'd go, what the what? This is not, I go to work.
Yeah.
I clean the car.
Yeah. What does this guy
do? What's this got to do with me?
Mm. So I read, again, something I thought was quite helpful. This is Ryan Britt. Genre in the mainstream, Richard Bortigan's In Watermelon Sugar. He said, like many of Bortigan's work, he asserts his absurd premises with almost aggressive casualness. Sounds like a paradox, but it's completely true. And I thought that was a really good way of summing it up, of like, there is such a casualness to this absurdity, to people dying, your tigers eating your parents and living on a commune. But it doesn't feel like he is knowingly saying, oh, there's something wrong with the world and I'm allegorically telling you about it.
It didn't feel like that he had a message he needed to give you. What it reminded me of, so you know in Edinburgh, and I know we'd bring it back too much to the Edinburgh Festival, but when someone gets a review of like being like a gentle comedian, wonderful hour, lovely storyteller, nice gentle show, because there were times where I thought, he could have like really banged in a joke.
Yeah, he doesn't.
Makes a conscious decision not to. The phrases I loved where he would slightly use the wrong word.
Yeah.
So the tigers were in bloom. Yeah. I really loved. Or how his father raised watermelons. they're almost the exact right word and we know exactly what you mean. But there's this lovely, her smile was the colour of her nipples. It's so nice because, you know, he knows exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, he's a good writer.
But he's not pushing it too far. This is what I mean about the cohesiveness of it. He is restrained.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was a poet as well. Mm. And I think you can, like you said, we're joking, it's short.
But maybe his poems were too funny and that's why he had to go write some silly books now.
He became...
imagine if you were reading it out, her smile was the colour of her nipples and everyone's laughing.
Her smile was the colour of her nipples.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
He became massively unpopular in the 70s and 80s.
Oh.
And I'm sure most people, he's quite famous for having killed himself in the 80s.
Like Hemingway did.
Yeah. But he really fell out of favour. because it's so of its time, because it's so psychedelic. And so then as novel writing obviously became about gritty and realism and like what's happening. And then obviously this, oh, it's Watermelon Sugar.
So when you
like,
say unpopular, was that active unpopular? Because I think people could be so sensitive, Richard Borcherton.
No, it lost in America. Like his books didn't sell as well. And he was massive in Japan. So he used to go to Japan and his second wife was Japanese American. And he was still popular in Europe. But America, he didn't quite, he was called the last of the Beats. And I think it was thought he was going to be, you know, as high and famous as the others. And he didn't quite reach, he's famous for those books, but he didn't quite reach the levels. And then his book stopped selling.
God, I'm so interested in like the money, because he sold 4 million copies of Trout Fishing in America.
That was his biggest one.
So what did you spend it on, Richard?
Just drugs, I think.
Just keep your money.
And the beginning of the book, I mean, I'm asking you here, like your teachers, we've all read this book and I'm going, help me. But so at the beginning, he doesn't like Margaret at all.
Well, he was with Margaret, but the beginning is after the event within Boyle.
So it's split into three books.
So we find out his emotions towards Margaret, then the backstory of
you find out what
being
happened
to loving
her,
Margaret.
They were clearly together. They were sort of coupled up.
Mm. Yeah.
But he rejects her after she hangs out
coupled
with...
Coupled up? We made it sound like Love Island. But there was a recoupling. He recoupled
I've only
with
seen
Pauline.
One episode. I meant it like in a 50s way. Like they were coupled up.
Oh, God.
He got a text. It's made out of watermelon sugar.
Oh, gosh. What's the other place they go to in Love Island?
Oh, Casa Amor.
Yeah, is that what that place is?
That's it. Next when you go to your shacks outside of Ideth.
Past Ideth is Casa Amor.
Margaret always walks across the bridge to knock for you.
Yeah. The walk. Imagine my
Margaret
hijama.
And Pauline are having a meeting in Casa Amor.
Imagine my hijama, just that walk she does going into the house, but that's she it. Steps on a squeaky floorboard.
Squeaky floorboard.
And they're like, oh,
every
no,
time.
She's here.
Every time.
She's
like,
here.
If we had 100 bridges that were a million miles long, Maya cannot, she cannot miss that floorboard.
That was something that I latched onto. And I, you know, when you read it, you're like, I don't know, you have to have a confidence, I think, to read. Not in... To literally read, but to understand it.
Yeah.
You have to read and you have to have this little voice in your head going, I understand this, I understand what's going on.
Doubt is very off-putting. Yeah,
and I kind of, I struggle with that a lot, especially with novels, because I just, you know, I'll kind of doubt myself constantly going, do you know what's going on here?
Yeah.
Can you remember who that is?
Yeah.
Okay, just skip the page. No one knows that you don't know it. Do you know what I mean? I'm constantly like that.
Oh, I do that, yeah.
So with this book, there was a couple of things at the beginning where I'm like distances, and he's always talking about like measurements of certain things.
Yes.
Or like the width of a river can be like a centimetre and all this
stuff.
Yes,
it's a really small river, yeah.
And again, that's where I'm doubting myself going, well, I don't know why he's telling me that. Is this a thing?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
But as the book goes on, it's a world where, and again, for somebody listening who's never read this book, space and time, it exists in that he kind of, you know, the sun is different color every day and all that, but it doesn't matter.
Like,
it doesn't matter how far away something is, although there is one point where he has to walk down to Pauline's shack and it's longer than he's told it is. That really winds him up. You know? It's also, only half a mile
like,
away.
Charlie has to walk quite far and he's old and he struggles with it. That's what that stuck out to me.
So there's a lot
of like, why is he struggling if there is no time or space? Like,
no, because it does exist. There is a geography. The outside and inside exist at the same time.
Yeah.
So you've got a living room that you have to cross under a river to get to. So he's quite insistent. I think it's intentional with this form, like with a surrealist painter who is going, the things you normally grip onto that make you feel safe because you're being told a story, I will not give you. How big's that? A million miles. Deal with it.
Yeah, the river
the Forgotten
is
Works is a
5
million,
miles and half
million
an
miles long.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's quite kid-like, you know.
How big
was that fish? A kid will stretch out their arms. Yeah. It was that big.
And when he says that thing about the very small river, he goes, we call everything rivers.
Yeah.
So then he's like, oh, great. So it's not a river you're describing to me.
You can't put your...
He calls rivers rivers.
Mm.
Yeah.
You can't put your feet down, ironically, on this novel. Like you can't, every time you think you know, I found that reading it every time I was like, okay, got it. Margaret's here, he's there. And then the next thing I'd be like, oh, hang on, no, they're not there. And the Forgotten Works is near, but not near.
Mm.
And then when they reveal that Imboyle is Charlie's brother, because I sort of imagine this sort of creature with Imboyle, it doesn't even seem almost human. And then Charlie seems like this lovely old man and you're like, oh, so one of them has turned really badly back to the past and seems to be obsessed with the part. Like, you're never...
It breaks rules.
Yeah, really constantly.
So there's a description of a statue and he doesn't know who it's of.
Yes.
And you would never have a writer tell you that. Here's a detail. I don't know who it is.
There's a lot of that, like at the end of the book.
It's a really, really abrupt ending.
I looked for the rest. I was like, that can't be ending. Come on, there must be another bit. What?
Well, when who's the bad guy?
In Boyle.
When he rocks up and he goes, right, we're going to go down there now. I'm going to show you what eye death is. Mm. And they're like, what are you going to do? He's like, oh, you'll find out. And he keeps saying, no one knows what's going to happen. Yeah. So you're reading it going, well, don't ask me. I don't know what's going on. And then they go down there and they cut off their noses and thumbs and kill themselves. And you're like... But they all look at each other going, don't know what happened there.
Yeah, that, like, I love that bit. That, like,
one of them's so drunk, reaction. He keeps poking himself in the wrong places. God.
But they're all pissed again. People listening go, what is this book? Boyle and all of his gang are all lashed on homemade whiskey.
But then that's such a strange moment because it seems really important and they die in front of them. But again, the people who live in eye death's reaction is like, oh,
Pauline's fuming. She goes to get her mop.
I love that. Last thing eye Boyle sees before he dies is Pauline with a mop mopping his blood.
Yeah, but so, annoyedly, yes. Oh, you've made a mess.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic image.
Yeah,
yeah.
But again, like, that makes me laugh because amongst the shape-shifting, everything made out of watermelon sugar, what tickles you is then this image of a woman just sighing, mopping up blood.
Yeah, very domestic, isn't it?
This
real.
Bloated, bogeyman just kind of dies off.
That's the thing about the
head off, basically.
When there are little moments which do feel to be reflective of the real world or real human behaviour, Pauline in that moment, the disaffected, unhappy men wanting to go and live in the past, which is the forgotten works, and drink whiskey. That feels authentic.
Yeah, that's authentic.
That decision, the fact that certain men at a certain point got unhappy with what's going on, so I'm going to go and drink within Boyle instead and go through the old stuff.
Yeah, that's very much what helps when you're reading, like, is he like the beatnik? And they're the generation that, you know, went through World War II and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Drinking whiskey going, oh, you don't know what eye death is really like.
Yeah.
But he doesn't... I don't think I'd be, you know, if I was someone who, I don't know, was born in the 20s and gone through World War II and I hate beatniks, this isn't convincing me that I'm wrong. I'm reading it like...
And now I feel very strong, like post-COVID, like if kids in 20 years are like, oh God, like, so what? Who cares? You guys need... And now I really feel for those people, those like 19, like we were grown up like being like, oh, those 50s parents were so uptight and the 60s kids were just trying to grow their hair and be cool. Now you're like, I'm on the side of the 50s parents. They didn't fucking know what real life was, yeah? They hadn't lived, okay?
If my son in 15 years goes, I've written a book, I'm like, yeah? He goes, yeah, everything's made out of Chinese five spice and, you know, you old gits are like moaning about how you had it tough, whereas we just get on, yeah? I'd be like, right. I'm going to cut my nose off and my ears. I'm going to drink a bottle of whiskey and you're going to watch me die, okay? That'll show you.
That's a bit of life for you.
There's a horrible bit. Well, not horrible. This sort of bit I found really tricky where Pauline is friends of Margaret and she says, after Margaret is dead, she says, this is horrible. So Pauline said, I feel so bad. Why did she kill herself? Was it my fault for loving you? So there's an emotional reaction. He says, no, it was nobody's fault, just one of those things. But we were such good friends. We were like sisters. I'd hate to think it was my fault. Don't, I said. Yeah. And I found that really, and that's the end of that piece, that chapter, if you can call it a chapter. It was like, there's this, people are feeling emotions, but nobody encourages them, elaborates on them, which actually isn't very 1968, because that was all about like, you feel what you feel and we can, you know, like, we need to get this out there and birth of psychology, you know what I mean? So I found that really strange that people do feel in the book, but nobody ever allows them anything further.
It's devoid of noise to a point where, and it's actually, it's a beautiful part of the book. It sums up grief because grief obviously can be very violent. But again, to explain, when Margaret dies, they start building her a tomb and they use, forgive me if I'm not getting this completely right, but like blocks of watermelon sugar, but
they're clear.
Are, they're soundless as well.
Oh, yeah.
There's no sound. There's for about
like
five
Wednesdays
pages.
Wednesdays are black and soundless, yeah.
So for five pages of the book, nothing makes a sound.
Yeah. Like, oh, yes,
by,
that bit,
by
yeah.
Put, by, like, put some, you put something on a table.
It doesn't make a noise, yeah.
And it had a weird effect on me in that I've never read a book before where I heard that silence as much as here.
He's
saying, he's just describing how nothing made a sound, the sound of your feet on the floor or the procession, the funeral procession, is in complete silence. Now, usually you read that and you can almost hear still, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, you can't believe it.
Yeah, but I completely believe the silence here. And it was just quite, I thought, a beautiful way of writing about grief, in that there is that detachment of when you're grieving, you're sat there, life is still happening around you, the wake, there's many people around you still drinking and chatting, but you feel detached from it and silent. So behind that wall, and I'm sure in this book that wall would be made of watermelon fucking sugar.
Or trout oil.
That silence really... really hit me, but oddly, because it's not a very loud book, it's a very gentle book.
Yeah, yeah.
The burbling of the river and the lanterns, and you know, it doesn't surprise me that it was big in Japan.
Yeah, yeah,
because
yeah.
I absolutely was picturing for a lot of this a beautiful Japanese garden.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
There's a tranquility to it
and the simpleness.
Also, they're
of
obsessed
it.
With watermelons because they invented the square ones that you could stack neatly.
Clip it up. That's the ad. That's the ad.
I thought, going back to grief, obviously, I'm going to try.
Always I like, with you.
I like to do. I really liked, like you said, that bit about grief, but I really liked this description of this land they're living in, that the dead are buried, not really buried, they're in the river in glass tombs, yeah. And you can see them and they're lit by lanterns.
I struggled picturing this.
Oh, I could really, well, I think I was very Lord of the Rings picturing, like.
I was getting Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I was getting full Lord of the Rings.
Richard Broadcombe would have loved to have written Lord of the Rings.
He would have.
That we'd still be around.
He would, that's too long for him. That's too much.
It completely reminded me of that.
Maybe if he'd kept going more than 3 months.
I'll be honest though, when I read it took him 3 months, there was a tiny part of my brain that went, maybe I can write a book in 3 months. I've got a parable. No one needs to know that I don't know what's happening.
I could be an American classic, Last of the Beats. 3 months, no problem.
3 months, fuck it, get it down.
Let's go.
Vintage, hello?
I think there is a bit in Lord of the Rings where someone is, isn't it? They're placing the boat on the river. It's Boromir. And that's what it reminded me of. They put Boromir in the canoe and they sail him down, don't they, in Fellowship?
Yep.
Yeah, so I think
do
that's
you,
what
Do
it,
you know what she's talking about?
From the films.
I like the first one.
Yeah.
Right.
I like the first one. For the same reason I like this book, it's a fantastical land.
Yeah,
but there's nice scenes where they're like eating and
yeah, they're jolly and they're getting on as lads, having a good time on a little adventure.
I can hook onto that.
Yeah,
Garrett, can we tell our listeners that you're a real dweeb about Lord of the Rings?
They know I'm a dweeb, and I would describe it as a genuine interested fan, Sarah, and not a dweeb of a classic book.
Go.
And one day
I was here when the friendship broke down.
He was living in San Francisco. He was part of the counterculture movement. He was like, that was the birth of a movement that we in England, like, are aware of, picked up on it, and, you know, inspired the beat. You know, obviously, it's a huge, huge movement. He was at the centre of it. How do you deal with being at the centre of a movement, writing a book that is like part of that movement, and then the world moving on? That must be hard to go, oh, nobody cares about your psychedelic watermelon sugar moment now.
So it would be like women in comedy. It's a moment, and then in 5 years back, we're not on panel shows anymore.
Well, I can believe that could happen. Like, so and then, that can happen.
And then you're just saying, hey, remember what you said about Richard Brautigan? You just got to be fine with this.
Yeah. Well, like, but even bigger than that, obviously, because the psychedelic moment was it changed everything. It changed film, books, like culture, you know, the drugs we take. Like, it's
but
that groundbreaking.
But in all creative fields, there are trends, and then there are people who they're young, they're at the cutting edge, they're speaking on behalf of everyone, they're reflecting back to society, and then they stay stuck in that.
Yeah, true.
And newer, younger, different.
I mean, he was diagnosed as schizophrenic in 1955 and treated with
which
ECT.
Is well before he wrote this book.
Yeah.
And had definitely. I didn't know. Yeah. Okay, I didn't know.
Yeah, that. So like that's what I mean. Like, it wasn't just that he wasn't popular anymore. Like, he was a quite. There was a lot of mental health issues, and his childhood like, yeah, a lot of stuff going on.
Was it?
Yes.
Which
really
then,
awful.
I was thinking, what if I read this book when I was 15?
I would have loved this book as a teenager.
Yeah. And I think it, I'm not saying that that's who he wrote it for, but at that age, reading a book like this, you can see how it would maybe shape you or how you would think about, I guess that's what the beat poets.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what beatnik culture was. And I guess, like you were saying, Sarah, it moved on because those young people
weren't young anymore.
Grow up and realise the realities of it all, really. So it's of its moment, this book, certainly. But I'm not surprised it quickly, you know, because every young group of people react to the past.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever
but
young
there,
thing
but
was.
There are some stories. So what's hard with this is you're not given a real story to grip onto for reasons that we've already examined in terms of you don't have human reactions, and that is what we click onto in stories.
Yes, yes, that's true.
So this book can't compete with Catcher in the Rye, which will be rediscovered by every generation.
Although I still enjoyed this book.
Yes.
And I still am like, I had never read it. When I picked it up, I was a bit like, oh my God.
But we've stopped pressing it into disenfranchised teenage boys' hands.
Yeah.
Whereas Catcher in the Rye is still going.
But I think it's interesting that this is still being published by Vintage as a classic and still being discovered by people. And despite us saying the world moves on, because it isn't of a specific time, because it is kind of fantasy, you can still read it in 2023 and still find things you relate to. Like, I still think it stands up to a read, and it's a short read, so you've got no excuse not to.
And now because it has the theme tune by Harry Styles. I should say, The Abortion.
Yes, he wrote another book called Abortion, A Historical Romance.
Which is very much a story and is the best book I've read about abortion. About a couple travelling to Mexico for a termination.
Wow.
And it's really, really real.
Is it?
Real world, yeah.
Can I tell you that in March 1994... a teenager named Peter Eastman Jr. from California legally changed his name to Trout Fishing in America. And now he teaches English at Waseda University in Japan.
Oh, so eating square watermelons.
Yeah, eating square watermelons.
His name's Trout Fishing in America.
His name is Trout Fishing in America, which, to be fair, in Japanese might be easier because you'd have like four kanjis for that, wouldn't you?
So you think that's why he moved?
It might be. I imagine saying, sorry, Mr. Trout Fishing in America, I'm just not going to get that essay back to you.
Well, if his first name is Trout, his surname
his
is
whole,
Fish.
No, his name is Trout Fishing in America.
Considering what he's wrote about before.
Yeah.
And the biography that you just gave, Carrie, out of what he's gone through.
Yeah.
I found this book quite cleansing.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Very calm.
Yeah.
It's like, it's very delicate.
Delicate is the description on the back one from Malcolm Bradbury.
John. Did you think it was delicate, fantastic and very funny? John read the back.
Well,
was it also charming and original, The Times?
There we go. Again, you know, if someone's listening to this and they're like, you know, there might be a future guest, don't use the quote on the back. They will, Sarah, specifically. I think Karen would have let me go.
I've never seen
a move so quick.
Yeah.
Flip the book round and went, oh, that's interesting you say that, because back of the book says it as well.
I actually meant it. Like, that's correct.
That's correct, John. You had a correct
Malcolm
reaction
because
you agree
novelist.
With Malcolm Bradbury.
All I said was the word delicate.
We're coming to the end. We all enjoyed this book very, very much. Do we have a last
slide? Let him end on a high.
No, he said it was delicate.
I was trying to. Yes. I was going to say how cleansing it was.
Yes, it
and
is.
How beautiful it was. And he'd had such a tough life.
Yeah.
And he obviously, through writing, escaped into this dreamlike world.
It's escapism, yes. It's and like a babbling brook.
A teenager, you can imagine, you know, teenage years are the toughest years you'll go through. So you open this book and you can just almost float away in what is a kind of...
Like Boromir on the lake.
Yeah, like Lord of the Rings. I mean, it takes a turn at the end of this book.
Yeah, it does take a turn. That doesn't happen in Lord of the Rings.
Actually,
Gandalf doesn't chop his nose off.
He doesn't.
Maybe Tolkien could have learnt a few things.
It is funny, though, that moment.
What, with Gandalf? No,
that moment
is
when they all kill... When
yeah,
they all,
it is. Like, it is. It's horrifically absurd... And in that absurdity is a kind of gross humour, definitely.
Yeah, it kind of almost I can't remember who wrote it now. There's a play called Ubu.
Richard Bortigan.
Yes, probably.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But it's just that kind of very, it's you can imagine that being staged. Mm. There's a very theatrical, absolutely bizarre, maybe theatre of the absurd kind of moment where, like we've said, they kill themselves the way they do. And what is absurd about it is that they keep on saying, we're doing this for a point. Mm. We're showing you. It's just so desperate and sad and weird and like.
And for something that doesn't have a lot of emotion in it, the characters, you feel a lot of emotion seeing what these people are doing. And like you said, like it's horrific, it's grotesque, it's funny, it's sad, it's awful. But the characters aren't emoting. They're getting their mop and bucket and cleaning it up. Do we have a last line for In Watermelon Sugar to say goodbye
well,
to us?
I think this line is so exceptionally beautiful.
Yep.
But it is the last line of Margaret.
Oh yeah.
But mm-hmm. I just thought this was so beautiful. She took the loose end of the scarf and tied it to a branch covered with young apples. She stepped off the branch and then she was standing by herself on the air.
Yeah, that's that reminded me of the Seamus Heaney quote that he has on his gravestone. Walk on air against your better nature.
Oof.
I completely agree with you. That line hit me. You know, risk.
Mm.
Live life. Doing something you don't want to do, maybe. Like, just try it. And yet she's found that peace in death.
We got very, like, that became full Radio 4 book after we were giggling the whole way through, that we actually had, I think you did read this book. I think you did.
That line, though.
Come back next season and read all of Lord of the Rings.
Oh, we'll do a full. That's going to be 3 episodes. You can do Fellowship and then we'll find someone else for 2 Towers.
I'll tell you what's nice, though, is you read a book usually and then you put it down and, well, unless you're part of a book club or something, you're like, well, there we go. Like, then maybe 2 weeks later, you talk to a mate, have you ever read this? Always no. I love that you've just picked that line out because obviously reading is a very private thing and it does hit you and you go, well, that was great. But you wonder if anyone else has noticed. So genuinely, thank you for inviting me on.
Thank you so much,
John. Thank you for being here. It was lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Weirdos Book Club.
John is on tour with his show Varnishing Days throughout October and November, and you can find him on Twitter at John's Fur Coat.
Next week's book guest is Love Nina by Nina Stibbe, and we will be joined by comedian and actor Rachel Paris.
My novel Weirdo is available to buy in the shops, as is Cariad's book You Are Not Alone.
Thank you for reading with us.
We like reading with you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Lucy Beaumont.
And guess what? I'm Sam Campbell.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy our podcast. It's called Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.
We have a podcast and It might be, I probably don't want to sound, you know, like I'm bragging, but it's dynamite. It is electric. It's high voltage. And please, we really need you to listen. You don't understand how much we need this.
Is it on all the platforms?
Oh, it absolutely is. But yeah, this one is coming. This one's out now. Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brands.